Hello and welcome to The Bunker, your daily need to know on news and politics with me, Andrew Harrison. Spotify. Since its launch in October 2008, the Swedish audio streaming giant has changed the way the world listens to music. No more paying to download individual tracks and then wrangling them onto your phone. We now expect music on tap wherever we are, and we expect podcasts too. Spotify is the second biggest outlet for our programs after Apple Podcasts. In fact, there's a good chance you're listening to The Bunker on Spotify right now. With over 574 million users who can choose from over 100 million songs and 5 million podcasts, you'd think that Spotify would be the textbook example of a technology colossus that's claimed the high ground and will hang on to it come what may. That, however, might not be the case. Despite the company's huge size and the eye-watering sums involved, Spotify had revenue of almost £3 billion in just 3 months to September. It is still, incredibly, an unproven business model. Though a price rise for subscribers and a round of cost-cutting has just put the company into profit for the first time in 18 months, Spotify's share price is still pretty much where it was when it floated back in 2018. Co-founder and chief executive Daniel Ek says the latest results prove that Spotify will become a great business. Emphasis on the future tense. And then there's the vexed question of exactly how much it pays the musicians it depends upon. Tales abound of artists being paid fractions of pennies for thousands of streams. Does a great product guarantee a business success? Can you run a massive music business when large numbers of artists actually hate you? And can Spotify even survive when its great competitor Apple Music has the minor advantage of being owned by the world's biggest company? Here to explain it all and to stream a little stream with me is music business writer and friend of the podcast, author of Leaving the Building, The Lucrative Afterlife of Music Estates, and the upcoming 1999, the year the record industry lost control. It's out in March. It's the Dr. Pop of Ballymena, Eamon Ford.
Hello.
How are you doing, Eamon?
I'm very well. I hope I get a per royalty stream for everyone listening to this podcast.
We will send you a micro payment.
Excellent.
A nano
payment. All I deserve.
It is all you deserve. So Spotify launched at the end of the 2000s after Apple's iTunes had effectively rescued the music business from the kind of the downward spiral of illegal downloads.
Yeah.
Can you explain to us exactly how it became so central to the music business's recovery in the 2010s and in the 2020s?
What you need to understand is that the moment when Spotify launched was kind of effectively halfway between what turned out to be a 14-year decline, straight decline for the record business, impacted in part by digital, but also all through the 1990s, the CD market was such a phenomenal growth curve that in many ways it was kind of artificial. It was so inflated that to take it as normal was a very dangerous thing because this was not just a replacement cycle. The per unit cost was phenomenally higher. So interestingly, 1999, I wrote a book about it, was the peak year for record sales, for CD sales. So you're coming off this quite unnatural bubble anyway in the 1990s, and something had to give, and obviously digital gave or took. And the industry was not so prepared for this. It hadn't made its music available digitally. Then you had the rise of Napster and then everything, Grokster and everything else that came after it. So there was a direct knock-on effect.
So this is all the illegal download services.
Yes, yeah. But also then in 2003 in America, 2004 in Europe, Apple was able to launch the iTunes Music Store. And that shifted the business model dramatically because obviously they were competing against free. So you get everything free on Napster or Audio Galaxy or LimeWire. And they were shifting the business model from this kind of $18 CD business to a $1 per track business. So rather than buying the whole album, you could cherry pick a couple of tracks, and that was it. So you suddenly, when people were buying, iTunes was a proven purchase model, and it was a brilliant model while it worked. And then it didn't work, and they didn't have anything immediately to replace it. So then Spotify was very much the child of peer-to-peer. Peer-to-peer is effectively connecting a series of computers. Napster worked on that, where there wasn't a single kind of storage point where all the music was stored. You connect it. If you were online and somebody in Australia was online at the same time and they had their hard drive open to share, you could kind of peer in and take music. So it was basically the consumer was also the distributor simultaneously. So Spotify was very much built on that basis. The early version of Spotify was actually drawn on peer-to-peer client software anyway. It was, the technology wasn't in itself wrong or illegal. It was the ways and means that it was put to that were causing problems for the record industry. And Daniel Ek was very much inspired by Napster in the sense that he said, well, obviously music's free. They've made music free. This is the great revolution of digital. At that early stage for music was that the entry price is zero and it could potentially stay zero forever. So his thesis was that he wanted to create a service that could compete with free and be better. So that was the kind of foundation for Spotify. Spotify was not the first music streaming subscription service because you had Rhapsody, which had launched in the US in the early 2000s. Napster, when it went through various ownerships and after long protracted court cases, was offering something similar. But Spotify's big play was what was called freemium, which was free and premium at the same time. It's an awful, ugly word, but it effectively describes the fact that Spotify is simultaneously a free service with limited access. So if you're listening on the free version, you can't store stuff on your phone and you get ads every number of tracks and so forth. Or premium, and that's it. You can cache everything on your phone. You have unlimited plays, unlimited repeats, unlimited skips. So their whole model was draw people in who are using these peer-to-peer things, potentially filling their hard drives with spyware or corrupted files or dodgy files or whatever, and get them into a completely licensed environment. Nothing on Spotify is unlicensed, so it's all approved by the record labels. And it's also an access model. You technically don't own anything. It's not like you bought an MP3 or a download from iTunes and you own it in perpetuity. So this whole access model was about just making everything on demand.
So to what extent is it built to favour the record labels? Because, you know, the labels have had their fingers burnt badly when Apple kind of rescues them, but they find they've got to do business on Apple's terms, and Apple sets the chunk that Apple will take, describes how the future of downloading is going to be. And then Spotify arrives with the next technology, which is streaming. And the labels seem to grab it with great enthusiasm. To what extent is it built for them? And to what extent is it built by them?
It's not built by them, but to get Spotify off the ground, Daniel Ek had to get the labels on side. And it's really interesting that Spotify took off in Sweden and was developed in Sweden first, because by the early 2000s, Sweden had the highest per capita internet access. And also you had the rise of things like the Pirate Party. So it was like the Swedish record industry was being destroyed by piracy on a scale that the UK or the US industry wasn't. So it was like the labels were small anyway because they were outposts of the European headquarters, generally in London, of the major labels. So Daniel Ek was kind of coming along with this solution at a time in a market that desperately needed someone to come along with a solution. So it was these partial licenses that were being offered out just to see, let's give it a test. And obviously part of those negotiations, as was very common for all digital startups from the late 90s, was that the rights holders, in this case the labels, would get an equity stake in Spotify, which they all did. So that was the attraction for the labels to go, okay, you've got equity in this. So if it sells or if we IPO, you have an upside, but also you have a stake in this service that can potentially define your future.
So if you look at the short term, it's actually been a very good year for Spotify. They added something like 10 million subscribers just at the end of last year. The stock price is up 75% from that trough that it hit around the tech slump.
Yeah.
And it's just turned a £198 million quarterly loss into a £30 million profit. So in the short term, you know, my kind of introduction, can Spotify survive?
Yeah.
Looks ridiculous because they seem to be on a bit of a tear at the minute. But over the longer term, when even Daniel Ek himself can't say this is a successful business.
Yeah.
What is going on? Is this a business that is going to be around, say, in 10 or 15 years?
I absolutely think it will be. Whether or not it is independently owned, even though you can't say it's independently owned because there are so many major investors. So maybe it gets sold. Maybe Daniel Ek has enough and goes, well, I've taken it as far as I can go. I'm going to sell it to someone else. It's a massive, massive part of the music industry. Based on IFPI figures, IFPI is the International Federation for the Phonographic Industry, which is effectively the trade body for record companies globally. So it lobbies on their behalf, it deals with issues of piracy, but more importantly, every year it publishes the numbers. So all those numbers that you'll see about the value of the recorded music industry come from the IFPI and its various offices around the world. Their latest figures, streaming, and that's ad support and subscription streaming, is about 2/3 of the global record industry. So obviously there are some markets where physical is still dominant. There's bits and pieces of downloads and so forth, but across the globe, 2/3 of the business is now streaming. And within that, they don't break it out by service, but there's a research company called Media who broke down some of the numbers, and they estimate that Spotify's got about 1/3 of the streaming business. So Spotify's 1/3 of 2/3 of the global record business. So right, it's big, but it's not the global streaming business.
Bring it back to the artists. I mean, it's almost a commonplace in the music business to hear artists slagging off Spotify. We've seen artists pull their stuff off the service.
Yeah.
We've seen people like Beyonce and Coldplay delaying their releases. Tom York famously pulled his stuff off Spotify and then put it back on again.
Yeah.
So did Taylor Swift. Do artists have that option anymore to say, we don't want to work with this thing?
Those arguments against Spotify were important and vociferous a few years ago. You will get occasional artists who will get a royalty statement and they'll publish it and they'll just go, this is disgusting. But the idea of anyone pulling their music from any streaming service, and that would include things like YouTube, seems unlikely at the moment. I think a lot of artists, for better or for worse, understand the power of this in terms of reaching an audience. They will also bemoan their lack of power within that to generate what they feel is fair revenue for the consumption of their music. But the idea of anyone pulling their music now, and it would have to take something exceptional for that to happen. And whether or not there could be some kind of organized union of musicians in the same way that you saw the writer's strike and the actor's strike in America, in Hollywood, like really going toe-to-toe with the Hollywood studio system. But musicians are not organized in the way. There are organizations like the Featured Artists Coalition, which lobby on behalf of artists for this, but I don't think that would happen. But they will. They obviously will publicly bemoan how little they get. If they're at the bottom end, if they're at the bottom of the food chain, you will get the crumbs. If you're one of the top 100 streamed artists, if you're Bad Bunny or you're Coldplay or whatever, you're doing very, very well out of Spotify.
Well, that connects to, you know, the one thing that lots of people do know about Spotify is that the payment system is odd.
Yes.
You might think, I'm paying £10 a month for Spotify.
Yeah.
And I'm doing nothing but playing Half Man, Half Biscuit the whole time. And I assume that my 10 quid is going to Nigel in Birkenhead.
Yeah.
Because I've only listened to his music and that's where my money's going. And that absolutely isn't what happens, is it?
No. It's a pro rata system, which is very complicated and it's not unique to Spotify. So you pay £10 a month. It's gone up to 11 in the UK, but let's keep it at 10 because it's a rounder number. 30% of that immediately goes to Spotify. That's their cut. So the remaining 70% is split up in lots of complex ways between record companies and music publishers.
But basically, it's money goes to the songwriter and money goes to the people who actually played the music.
Yes. So you've got two sets of rights there, and there are different terms and they get different cuts and so forth. But under a pro rata system, they will just take a kind of, they will look at it over the month and just go, okay, who are the most streamed artists? So let's take an example. Let's say Bad Bunny, who's one of the biggest artists on Spotify. Let's say he accounts for 2% of all streams on Spotify for that month. Hmm. 2% of your £7 will be going to Bad Bunny, his record company, his publishers.
Even though I never listened to him.
Even though you didn't listen to him. So this is also identifiable in radio, where there's royalties for the songwriter and the performers and collection societies for those. And if they can't identify where music, all the music that was played, it all goes into this big pot. And then they basically go, who were the biggest, who were the most played artists? And then they carve it up.
So on radio, for instance, let's say that Coldplay are getting 0.5% of all the radio play.
Yes.
The money that they can't identify,
they'll get 5.5%
of it.
Yeah, because they just go, it's down to, and this will also be for public performance in like bars and cafes and all of these different things where people don't tabulate every single song that's been played. So when they can't identify it, it just goes into a pot and then they just go, this is the fairest way to carve it up. But that pro rata model is changing.
Right.
It will change with Spotify. There's been a long call for what they call user-centric licensing, which is what you alluded to at the start.
Basically, so that my £7
yes.
all goes to Nigel in Birkenhead because he only yes. plays records.
Exactly. Yes. So it's called artist-centric licensing or user-centric licensing. They have different names for it. A couple of years ago, SoundCloud started doing this. So that was the first service to do that. So this is a testing of the ground to go away from this pro rata thing to this, some will say, more equitable per user-centric licensing.
I want to know about the kind of rivalry with Apple, because it seems insane that a $30 billion company can be the underdog. Well, that's kind of what Spotify is.
Yeah.
Because Apple Music is backed by the world's biggest company, mm-hmm. which also has around it a massive industry of iPhones, Apple Watches, computers, and also huge loads of other digital services like TV and podcasts and all the rest of it. Mm-hmm. Traditionally, when you get a new media situation, I mean, some listeners might be able to remember what happened with digital television, satellite TV.
Yeah.
Effectively, you end up with one provider that ends up eating the smaller one.
Yes.
Is music going to be a world where there is Pepsi and there is Coke, where the little one can survive? Or does Apple have just too much advantage and it's got its own little world of stuff that it can keep you in, its own ecosystem where it can keep you listening to Apple Music on an Apple device while you watch Apple Telly through your Apple TV box and you just live in a world of Apple?
Yes and no. I think Apple were very late to streaming comparatively, and I think that was partly because of the legacy of Steve Jobs. He felt that it was a ridiculous proposition, this idea of renting music. He said, our customers want to own stuff. So they were very, very slow. So they had to buy up a company called Deezer that became Beats and turn that into what became Apple Music. So they were already trailing behind Spotify. And the one thing, the blessing and curse of Spotify, is this freemium thing. Apple Music doesn't have that. You can sign up for a 3-month trial or whatever, but it's the fact that you have to kind of pony up and pay your subscription from the off that kind of puts Apple at a slight disadvantage. Also, you have to kind of take in the viral effect. Sorry to use the word viral. But Spotify, because so many people are using Spotify, it's like over 500 million people now using Spotify, they're sharing playlists. So they will go, have you heard, here's my playlist I've done, or have you heard this song? And that's almost forcing Spotify onto all of their friend network as well by kind of going, this is the service I use.
Yeah.
So then you would have to go and you would either have to get a bit of software that could convert it into an Apple Music playlist, or you'd have to go manually type in the name or whatever. So the bigger Spotify gets, the bigger its kind of network effect. So it stays big in that way. So it's got, 500 million users, and around half of those are paying. So it kind of becomes still perpetuating in a way. And that's something that Apple Music and others don't have. And it's that whole thing about the big just stays big. So Apple is closing on Spotify, but I think based on that media research, I think they said that if Spotify's got 30% of the streaming market, Apple's got about 12 or 13. So it's still way behind, but it's growing. It's not an idle threat for Spotify.
All of these things, right the way from you talking earlier about the way the CD came in and transformed the music business and actually changed the nature of talent. It sort of brought classic bands like the Beatles and the Stones back into focus in a way that they hadn't been. All of these things are stories of changes in technology. You know, the CD kind of makes vinyl temporarily redundant and is then replaced by the digital download, which is then replaced by streaming. And then you get strange things like the bounce in vinyl, which has become a kind of fetish object. It's nowhere near as big as people think it is, but it has a romance to it. And younger listeners are getting into, you know, getting Taylor Swift on 5 different purple versions of limited edition vinyl and so forth. Do we yet know what's the next thing on the horizon that's likely to sort of change? Because, you know, looking at the, you know, the very idea, if you told me when I was 14 that one day there would be a, firstly, I didn't know what software was, but there'd be a piece of software that enabled me to play pretty much every piece of music that's ever been recorded, maybe 90% of what's been recorded, for free. I would have said you're out of your mind. Have we arrived? Is there any way to improve this now?
Yes, I think it's going to do, it's Moore's Law about storage capabilities, which is the idea that every year the ability of storage will double and the cost will halve. So it's like almost to the point where digital storage becomes negligible. It's like it becomes so cheap to store terabytes, billions of terabytes of data for not much money. I think kind of the end game would be something like having on your device a chip that has 60 million songs on it.
Right.
It's like storage at that level. At the minute, Spotify caps you out. So there'll be increased storage on your phone, but also it could get to the point where 60 million songs could be shrunk onto a chip that just sits on your phone. And then your subscription, it's there instantly, always available offline. You don't have to rely on a Wi-Fi connection. You don't have to rely on a mobile connection. It's there constantly, instantly accessible. It can be updated instantly. This is years in the future. This is not going to happen. It probably wouldn't happen in our lifetime. But that feels like the end game, because like at the moment, you're still relying on a mobile or Wi-Fi connection to fill up your phone. And if it comes effectively preloaded on a chip that's so small that it could hold tens of millions of songs, that feels like the future. And then your subscription basically gets you through. There's like a password area or it's locked. And then as long as your subscription renews, your phone will automatically give you access to all of that music. That feels like the end game to me.
And on the shorter term, what's your bet that's like of what's likely to happen with Spotify versus Apple in the next sort of 5 to 10 years?
I think Apple will close its lead on Spotify. I don't think it will. It's not going to overtake Spotify for a long time. I don't think Apple is in a position now to try this kind of freemium model. And it feels kind of counter to the philosophy of Apple, which is all very much, even though people disliked iTunes or whatever, Steve Jobs very much prized the idea of you pay for music, you pay for art, you pay for entertainment, whether or not that's 99 cents versus $18 or whatever, but he wanted people to pay. So that feels contradictory to the philosophy of Apple. But I think Apple's going to grow. I think Amazon is also going to grow. Amazon's going to scoop up the more casual listener. I think we will see a very slow but steady increase in pricing, because there was Spotify went up last month by £1 a month in the UK, and it had gone up in other markets. And Spotify said that in its recent numbers, it said that that didn't have a negative effect. It wasn't driving away subscribers, but that's not them going to be up and at £1 a year every year. It's going to be a couple of years before they do an increase, but that will become, it'll become normalized in the same way that Netflix or Disney subscriptions, they just go, they'll send you an email every year and just go, oh, your subscription's just gone up. And you go, well, okay, right, fair.
And are artists going to get paid any more under this?
Well, technically, but it depends on the terms of their contract with the label or so forth. So rather than £7 being carved up between all of the people that you listen to. So maybe this user-centric thing will be more egalitarian, maybe it won't. But rather than your £7 a month being carved up between all of these rights holders, is £7.33 is now going to be carved up.
Yeah.
Because it's gone up to 11.
Champagne all around.
Well, yeah, exactly. So yeah, it's going to be, it's going to be an incremental increase, but I wouldn't book the swimming pool builders just yet if you're some mid-level indie act.
Eamon Ford, thanks for joining me to explain the weird world of Spotify. Leaving the Building, The Lucrative Afterlife of Music Estates is out now. And 1999, the year the record industry lost control, is out in March. Will it be available as an audiobook on Spotify?
Not with me narrating it, it won't.
Listeners, remember, the best audio entertainment is podcasts because they're free. but we're not exactly a $30 billion business, and we owe our prosperity entirely to supporters like you. So if you want us to keep making independent podcasts and even listen to them on Spotify, why not support us on Patreon? You'll get early episodes without ads on them. You get mugs and t-shirts, special extras. All these things can be yours. Just Google Patreon Bunker Podcast to find out a bit more, or follow the link in the show notes. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow on your favourite streaming platform.
Hello, I'm Roz Taylor with news of Oh God, What Now?, the politics podcast that's never going to leave its voter ID at home. On Friday's show, it's 6 months until the US election and Donald Trump is stuck sitting on trial in a New York courthouse. Is he bulletproof, or can Joe Biden turn around the polls? In the second half, it's local elections week, but we've steadily taken power away from local authorities. What if we gave it back? And in the extra bit for supporters, is there a right level of ruthlessness in politics? That's Oh God, What Now? With me, Roz Taylor, Raphael Baer, Hannah Fern, guest Nikki McCann Ramirez, out now, wherever you get your podcasts.
The Bunker Daily was written and presented by Podmasters Group Editor Andrew Harrison. The producer was Liam Tate, and the audio producer was me, Jade Bailey. The managing editor is Jacob Jarvis. With music by Kenny Dickinson and artwork by Jim Parrott, The Bunker is a Podmasters production.